Okay. Good morning. Mazel tov.
Thank you.
Let us. We're on. We're going to do Daf Yud Chet today. When you sign on a bet toward the bottom.
Is that supposed to be working?
No.
Okay.
Is it working? Good. We are on the second daf of the second perek of Megillah. We've so far accomplished one entire perek, which was, for want of a better term, meandering around a central question about how to sustain a society in diaspora, holding on to the hope of return to a landed national autonomy, how letting go of that hope will inescapably lean to national decline, and also along the way establishing a hierarchy of priorities for society. We discussed the need for burying the dead, respecting those who are the embodiment of the constitutional law, Torah scholars, etc. And we finished with these three remarkable statements suggesting that Talmud Torah, the study of law, comes above almost everything else, including Hatzalat Nefashot, saving lives, respecting parents, and building the Bet Mikdash. These are three central tenets, and yet we say learning Torah comes before all of them in some kind of hierarchical sense. And we noted that that is not a concrete, practical hierarchy, in the sense that if you have a choice between going to a Daf HaShavua Shir or saving somebody's life, you say, well, they said Talmud Torah Kodem Hatzalat Nefashot, I'm going to go to Daf HaShavua.
You get bagels too.
And you get bagels too. So it's also Hatzalat Nefashot. We've said that that is not clearly what is being meant here, although it is taken that way. And we said in passing, this that text is used quite strategically in the argument that is unfolding right now in Israel about whether those who are engaged in Talmud Torah should be drafted into the army. When people say it's Pikuach Nefesh, you say, okay, but it says Talmud Torah Kodem Hatzalat Nefashot. Mordechai was criticized for serving in politics and trying to protect Jewish interests by the Sanhedrin because he gave up on learning. And there's a whole discussion around that in Gemara as well. But that brings that first perek to a close. That Talmud Torah, in some hierarchical sense, even if not practical, when in conflict, is the most potent priority in terms of sustaining a people in exile. We pivoted to the second chapter, and in some ways this is going to be, now that we've established that part of what you need to survive in exile is hope, is a story of redemption, that God is protecting you, even when you are away from home, that you have a relationship. The question now becomes, how do we tell a story? How do we engage the audience? How do we instill hope? And there are going to be some surprising turns along the way when I have prospective converts come and, you know, ask what's required of the process. Along the way, reading Hebrew is very important. And they say, oh, and, you know, I assume I have to understand everything. I say, well, you have to be able to read Hebrew, but you shouldn't assume that until you understand everything in the Siddur or everything that's being laned, you can't cross the threshold. The majority of practicing born Jews don't understand most of what's in the Siddur or a lot of what's in the Siddur when they're hearing laning. And even though that might sound like a weak confession, Chazal are going to say, yeah, we understand that that's part of the system. And even confess that the greatest Torah scholars, there are things we don't understand, but we have to hear it anyway, which goes to the question, so what is the point of reading the text that we're reading and telling the stories that we're telling? But the first question posed is, does it have to be read in order? The Megillah, can I read chapter 2 and chapter 1, chapter 5, chapter 3? Can I make it a what kind of books is that called? Choose Your Own Adventure? Can I do that? And the answer is no. It can't be read out of order. Lema Freya, it has to be read in a straightforward order, which makes sense. If this is about instilling hope, sometimes we may assume that as human beings, as long as we get information downloaded, it doesn't really matter what order. I got all 10 chapters. Does the order matter? I downloaded the information. And the claim being made here is, yes, the manner in which we absorb information is key. And this is, of course, true when you're having conversation with people. If you're breaking bad news to somebody, you shouldn't like... There is a way strategically to communicate that news. And if you want to give somebody a surprise because you've got good news, there's a way to break good news in a way that will most move them and engage them. And just to say, well, I gave you all the information, so it was out of order. So I opened the sentence with, I'm never going to see you again. And then I finish with, I really like you. That's like a really bad way to communicate those pieces of information, even though the semiotic content is getting there. So the assumption here is order is important. And we transition talking about Megillah and say, okay, that's true for Megillah. Is that true for Hallel? And we said there are four different proofs that Hallel has to be said in a certain order. There is a logic to the chronology. And then we said, what about Tefillah? With Kriyat Shema, we said, yes, and now we're in Tefillah. Now we're saying, okay, now that you've said order is important, tell me why the Amidah, the Shemona Esrei, is in the order that it's in. Why do we begin with a bracha about the forefathers, about Avot, and then go to Tchiyat HaMeitim, and then to Da'at, and then what is the order? And we're now three medium lines down on your Zayin Amud Bet, and we're up to the ninth bracha, Birchat HaShanim, which seems on its face to be a bracha about prosperity. We say, may we have these wonderful, prosperous years where we're full of blessing and productivity. So at the third line toward the end, Mara Ulomar, Birchat HaShanim, first one on HaShanim, fourth line, B'chit. Why do we say this bracha about prosperity number 9? And we've established so far why number 8 is about refuah, how you balance that with slicha and geula and binah. And now we're wondering about prosperity. Amar Rabbi Alexandri says, Keneged Mafkei Sharim. You want to know what this bracha is really about when you talk about prosperity? It is not just that we want the rich to prosper. This is actually a bracha that is to combat those who raise rates, who manipulate the market so that they can make a lot of money. Dichtiv, how do I know that this is against those who raise rates, which affects the poor? Shavuz or Rasha, there is a verse that says God should break the arm of the wicked. And in the context, it says, who are the wicked? The verse continues, those who steal from the poor. Now I'll ask you a question. If you wanted to be a successful thief, who do you try to steal from? Yeah, the rich. It seems like a very odd plan to steal from the poor. So the assumption that Chazal have with that verse is, oh, who steals from the poor? The people who raise rates on food. It's not, you know, a scheme to get rich quick. It's a scheme to exploit those who are in desperate need, to raise the prices while demand is high, and you end up squeezing the pockets of the poor. That's who the wicked are when we say Birchat Hashanah, may you have a good blessing. And where does that Tehillim appear, where David talks about the Mafkia Sharim? David Kiamra B'Tshiyat Amra. He says that in the ninth psalm, which means we should say it as the ninth bracha. And what we're seeing is there's a pattern here. The reason we say Avot first, followed by Tchiyat HaMeitim, is because David HaMelech, in his Tehillim, Ma Havu La Hashem B'nei Elim, Havu Shalom Kavo V'Oz, we talk about God's representatives and God's power. So Tehillim is in many ways the model for the order of our prayer. So because it's the ninth psalm, it's the ninth bracha. And why after Birchat Hashanim we talk about prosperity, we go to talking about bringing in the exiles? Is that a natural chronology? Because in this verse, the logic is described as Israel will start to thrive, meaning you will spread out your branches and you will raise up your fruit. You'll become prosperous, ki krav lavo, because you'll start coming in. So there is a logic set up between prosperity and the return of exiles. That's why they are in conjunction. V'kivin shenatzu galiyot, and what happens after everyone gathered in? Na'asa din b'rishayim. That's when justice starts to unfold upon the wicked. So there is almost a messianic logic here that we're tracing out the chronology. We say, please let us prosper. And what do we expect or hope for after prosperity? Kibbutz Galiot. So please bring in the Galiot. And once everyone's brought in, what comes next? Justice. You might think justice should come first and then you gather in the good. But everybody comes in and then we have a big justice. How do I know? Shnei Marfa, Ashiva Yadei Alach, Ve'etzrof Kavasi Gach. It says, I will bring in, I will return you all, and then I will purge you of the problem. And it says, and it says in the next verse, I will return your judges, which is why our next prayer, after we talk about gathering in the galuyot, the exiles, we turn to the 11th bracha of justice. And what happened? What's after this? This actually, even though we say it all the time, I had to print out a list of the brachas that we say. What's after we say Hashiva Shavtein Kurishona? Close. That's the same bracha. What's after that? V'lamal Shinim. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, we don't. So I had to print off this. I had to print off this list. V'lam al shidim, which is against the minim. V'kim shenasa din mershaim v'kalu posheim. And since we spoke about, and once the wicked are judged and all the wicked and all the sinners are dispensed with, v'kala zedim v'hem, it includes also the conspirers or the schemers. Shneimar, as it says, v'sheva posheim v'chataim yachdav, I will get rid of the schemers and the sinners together. V'kivin shekala posheim idramim k'seven tzadikim. And what happens once you get rid of the wicked? Who thrives? The righteous, which is why we then go to Alat Tzadikim, to the righteous. Dichtiv. So while we may think these are just a kind of a collection of themes, it is tracking out a hoped-for chronology. And I should say that there are some who use this to speak about contemporary Jewish life. They think about the states of the state of Israel and how Jewish history is moving forward and say, well, look, people are coming in. It's true, society isn't just yet, but look at the brachas we say. First we want kibbutz galiyot, and then we'll do justice. So if you're not from and you make aliyah, expect there to be some people who think, oh, now that you're here, let's start talking about what's righteous and what's not, and let's get rid of the schemers, and let's get rid of the wicked. So there are theologians, I guess you could use that word relatively loosely, who assume that these brachot speak to that reality. How do I know that tzaddikim thrive after the wicked are gone? I mean, it's intuitive, but it's also, there's a verse, Dichtiv, v'chol karnei resha'im agadeh, when I cut down the pride of the wicked, tidromama karno tzaddik, the pride or the horns of the righteous will rise. So it's not just that once the wicked are gone, you're all that's left, so you'll feel relief, but I'll actually raise you up and give you pride. V'chol el geri hatzedek imat tzaddikim, bless you. Those who are pure converts are together with the wicked, with the righteous. Shneimar b'nei sefer tach v'zata b'nei kazaken, because it says in one verse that you should stand up and give honor to the zaken. Sometimes we translate as elder, but here it means sage. B'samach leviki yagoret chem ger, and in the very next verse it talks about a ger, and they should go together. That's just a side point. That do not think that the righteous are those who are born in some kind of enshrined light. This is not predetermination, where the righteous are known from birth, but you can join the righteous over the course of your life. And where do these righteous and these righteous converts, where do they thrive? Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, which is why we then talk about Yerushalayim. So we've said, first you want to talk about prosperity. And once we've got prosperity sorted out, then we'll get to kibbutz galayot. Once we get to galayot, we'll have justice. When we got justice, we can get rid of the schemers. When we get rid of the schemers, we're then going to let the righteous thrive. And once the righteous thrive, we're going to talk about Yerushalayim, which is, again, why contemporary theologians say, yeah, the Yir HaTikvah, it's not sorted out. There's a lot in the Yir HaTikvah that doesn't seem messianic. We're on the way. We'll get there. How do I know it should be in Yerushalayim? Shneimar shalu shalom Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim o'avayech, that in Jerusalem is where the righteous will thrive. V'kivin shenivne Yerushalayim ba'David, and once Yerushalayim is built, that's when the Davidic monarchy will return. Shneimar, as it says, this is now onto Yudched Amud Aleph, right at the top. Achi Hashuvu b'nei Yisrael, after the Jewish people return, v'agshu at Hashem Eloheim, and they ask for their God, v'et David Malkam, and David their king. So it's after the return, after justice is meted out, after the wicked are dispensed with and the righteous fly high. That's when Yerushalayim and King David come to the Kivin Shabbat David Bata Tfilah. And once we talk about David, we say, oh, well, what's in the connection? What makes sense in terms of stream of consciousness when we talk about David? Tfilah. Shneimar. And it's actually not just stream of consciousness because the man himself speaks at Tfilah. But there is a progression here. Once the Davidic monarchy is established, we can talk about the power of prayer becoming more universal. As it said, "Vaviyotim al hakodshi, I will bring you to your holy mountain, v'simachtim b'veit tefilati, and you will rejoice in the house of prayer." So when we think about the power of prayer and ingathering, that is one of the last steps in the messianic trajectory. V'kivin shavata tefilah ba'avodah. Once tefilah is established, that's when the avodah starts. You want to know, when should we start the temple service? It's after the Davidic monarchy, after we've been in Jerusalem, after justice is meted out, after everyone's gathered in, after we're all prosperous. And once we've set up an international house of prayer, then we can start talking about the Avodah, Shneimar, Elotem, Ezevichem, Lerat Solom, Mizbechi. Because right after it talks about Tfilah, then it says, Elotem, Ezevichem, Lerat Solom, Mizbechi. The Kivin Shabbat Avodah, And once we bring avodah, and when I say, by the way, we should do this, there are, as I say, some theologians who say this is a kind of a script for us. The way we pray is not a script for us. This is an appeal that God should do these things. So it's a hope that this is a chronology. We understand how it's destined to unfold. And we're asking God, set up prayer. And we understand that that can't happen until David is established. And we understand the avodah can't happen until prayer is established. But we're now going to have some complications in terms of the order. And once we've said the avodah should be set up, that's when we talk about thanksgiving. It says sacrifices and gratitude will honor me. Sacrifices first, gratitude next, which is why we talk about modim after we talk about ritzei. How come berchat kohanim comes next? I would think berchat kohanim might come before avodah, and if it's at least not before avodah, when would I expect it to be? Right after avodah. It's connected to temple service, thanksgiving, modim. I think, you know, put that, why is that connected? Dichtiv, but how do I know Birchat Kohanim is after modim? As it says, Visaron is Avit Ha'am, Aaron lifted up his hands to the V'yarachem, and he blessed them, V'yarid Ma'asol Chatal V'olav Ishlamim, and he came down from doing the sacrifices. So, on its face, the order of the verse is, he does Birchat Kohanim, and this is, and he came down from doing sacrifices. Which one did he do first? So what gives you that impression?
It happened. Yeah. He said it happened. It did. The first part happened after the second part.
It's possible. It's possible not. It's possible that he raised his hands to thank the people and he came down from doing sacrifices and he did sacrifices after. But that, so this is going to be the question. The Gemara is going to say, hold on a minute. Ema kodem avodah. So maybe it should be before avodah. If you've just said he put his hands and then he came down from doing the chatat. Look again at the verse. It says he came down from doing the chatat. He came down to do it. No, it said he came down from doing it. So he clearly did it after the avodah, and then he did the berchat kohanim, and then he came down from having done all of that. So if that's true, the right after doing sacrifices, he did berchat kohanim. Why isn't it right after the avodah? You should have written, say, Birchat Kohanim, and then Modim. Why is Modim in between? Lo Sach Adasaf. No, you shouldn't think. Dichtiv Zevach Todah. We've already said it says Zevach Todah next to each other. So they should be next to each other. But now you've got two verses. One that says he did Birchat Kohanim and the Avodah, and one that says that Todah and Avodah go together. How do you pick which one to follow? My Chazit Samcha Hai Samcha Hai. Why are you leaning on that verse? Lean on the other. Mistavra. We've got some logic that plays here. Avodah Vahodah Chadam Miltahu. That service and gratitude on the same thing, and this is obviously a trope Chazal are establishing here, that avodah is not just an appeal, it's not a means of service, it's not some sort of magical ritual, it is connected to offering appreciation and thanksgiving. So actually, thematically, that leans us to the verse for Zovech Todah. So you should have avodah ritzei, followed by modim, because they're conjoined, and then you have Birchat Kohanim, because the verse says, Mechatat, he did the sacrifices, and then Birchat Kohanim. What's the last bracha? We've got Birchat Kohanim followed by Sim Shalom. How do I know you finish with peace? Mari Lama Sim Shalom Achal Birchat Kohanim. Why do I finish with peace after Birchat Kohanim? Dichtiv. Actually, if you look at the verse about Birchat Kohanim, it says, with Samuel Shemel B'nei Yisrael V'nei Varachem. God says, after you've done that, I will bless the people. So the last thing we should do is make an appeal for the blessing that God makes. What is that blessing? Baruch HaGadosh Baruch Hu Shalom. And the blessing that God gives is Pish Shnei Ma Hashem Yivarechet Amo V'Shalom. I know you just got excited to stand up and say Kaddish and do a Siyum or something. But that is the established sense that God's blessing is peace. And that's why we finish with that full stop. We've now established the Amidah, which is a blend of being modeled on Tehillim, run by a certain logic, and establishing a certain order in the hierarchy of eschatological trajectory, that the end of times will unfold in a certain way, and that's how we pray, and Birchat Kohanim is connected because that always follows Avodah, even though that's not part of the Messianic vision. So it's kind of a blended way where we kind of almost stream of consciousness, what comes next, logically we run through, but it is, as we're davening, on a random day, standing in the middle of the diaspora or in the middle of Galut, let's say, wherever you are, what should I be engaged in prayer? What am I thinking of that makes my prayer continuously resonate? And it seems to be a blending of I'm being King David, which means I'm already redeemed in some sense, and then reminding us that there is a trajectory, that we're not there yet. We want to establish prosperity in a certain order because that's the hope for the end times. And then we're almost like Aaron, who's already done the sacrifices. So again, we're kind of having this back and forth of not being overtly apocalyptic, where we are engaged. This is a prayer for a specific order. We're writing a script, and once I finish praying, I need to engage on this because we're not there yet. And it kind of stymies that sense by reminding us that actually we can embody David in some sense, and we can embody Aaron in some sense. And then we finish with peace, which almost puts I don't want to be overly homiletical here, or I guess homiletical at all really, but it's suggesting that once we've now established this mix of feelings that might lead somebody to become proactively messianic, I need to do something. I've just outlined these prayers. What am I? You know, chop liver, I can do this. And then we finish by Chazal saying the final bracha is peace, which should orient everything in terms of how to behave. That is the calculus, which means that we want to advance this vision somehow, but it has to be always mitigated strategically by what Chazal say is the overarching theme of divine blessing, which is peace. And that's how we have to manage our advance however we can. And that's a theme that emerges in Chazal all the time. Again, in Megillah is specifically the context where this is going to come to the fore. If you're looking for kind of a messianic tract, sometimes people will look to Sanhedrin because that speaks about the reestablishment of the justice system, the judiciary. But Megillah is how do we cope in exile when we want to have our hope, but it doesn't look plausible right now. Again, in the first chapter, we had discussions about the age of Rome. We had discussions of Shmuel Gamliel. How assertive should you be against your enemies at a time when you don't think you can win? Do you just sit back and, you know, what? Why are we, you know, I'm sure some of you have seen The Life of Brian. What's that? The Suicide Squad or something? Who like go to battle knowing they're all going to die. Like, is that the objective? And here we're now transitioning to the order of the stories that we tell ourselves from the Megillah to prayer. Full stop. We're now going to head. Oh, no, full stop. We now have got a question. We said, who established the order of prayer? We said it was the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. And then we said it was Shimon Bar Kuli. There were two different views. But hold on, now that you've told me that it was the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, essentially, that it was elders together with prophets, Shimon Bar Kuli, my history, what was Shimon Bar Kuli involved in? Why are there these two different views? Answer, Shichachum, the Chaz of Isidrum. It had been established by the Great Assembly, and then it was forgotten. And Shimon Bar Kuli essentially re-established the order, which, again, if we were being historians, we would ask, how did that dissolve or devolve over time? They had a prayer system, and then they forgot, or it was, like, arranged, and they didn't manage to communicate it to everybody, and then Shimon Bar Kuli re-established it. So, but they were both involved, and there were two faces. Full stop. Mikan Ve'elach, now that you've said that these are the 19 brachot, the 18 brachot of the Shemona Esrei, why is there no more? He says, any more than this, you can't add any Amidah. You can't just start adding brachot and think, oh, well, we didn't talk about this, I'm going to mention this brachot. Why can't you do that? There is a verse that says, Mi Yimalel Gvurat Hashem, who can portend or evoke the strengths of God, Yashmea Kondilato, and make heard all his praises. It sounds like what we call biblical parallelism, two parts of a verse that say conceptually the same thing. Who can speak the praises of God? Who can make all his greatness heard? But the way Chazal are going to read it is that these are actually two different claims. Lamina Elam Alagvot Hashem, who is it who can praise God? And then the answer is provided by the verse, Yashmea Kondilato, Lamisha Yachol Yashmea Kondilato, one who can make all his praise known. And who can make all the praise of God known? Nobody. So nobody should be saying extra things. It's almost a self-subversive verse which says, who can give the praise to God? No one. So you should be quiet. Meaning nobody can make Yashmei Kol Tzelato. So you shouldn't add anything other than what is scripted by the prophets and the sages. Amar Ruchanan Rabbi Yochanan, first word on the line, last medium line. Hamasapa b'shvach shekhar shvach yotu midai neka min ha'olam. Not only shouldn't you do this, bless you, but one who does engage in praise of God, yoter midai, too much, ne'ekar min ha'olam, is uprooted from the world. Now, is that a threat of punishment? If you do that, you'll be uprooted? Is that a suggestion that if you try to engage in divine praise too much, you kind of detach yourself from reality. You become this kind of mystic ascetic who's in a cave trying to identify with God. And in the meantime, the world is crumbling and there are things you could be doing as a human being. And you've become some sort of Gnostic who's engaged in trying to reach and transcend material life. It could be read either way. Shneamar, there is a verse, Hayusupar lo ki yadaber, one who speaks to God when they speak, imama ish ki yivala, if a person tries to do this, they will be swallowed up. So it sounds again like a threat. If you try to praise God too much, you will be uprooted. But it could also say, you try to do this, you're just going to be engulfed in this project, full stop. There are two versions of where Rabbi Yehuda was from. This Rabbi Yehuda, my dichtiv, and he says, why does it say in Tehillim, Lacha dumia tehila, to you silence is praise, sama de kula mishtuka, that the greatest medicine of all is silence. And there's this trope, which again repeats through rabbinic literature elsewhere. I'm told actually once, I was not there, maybe you were there, I was told there was a gush dinner a while ago, where one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Yehuda Amital was flown in specially to be the guest speaker. And, you know, people go to these dinners because they don't have a chance to hear. Certainly in a pre-YouTube age, didn't have the opportunity to hear the Rosh Yeshiva speak that often. And people came in to the Hilton or Grand Hyatt, whatever it's called, for this dinner. And sometimes dinners go on a little bit too much. And by the time it was Rav Amital's chance to speak, he got up to the podium and everyone was, you know, this was the main event. And he said, Ein chochma ele shtika, and then sat down. And that was the end of his speech. No, that takes guts. But also people remember it when you do that kind of thing. There was a similar thing at a Reitz event right after I got smicha. They had Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz from Chicago come in. And it was around this time of year. So, you know, in the lead up to Pesach. And there were lots and lots and lots and lots of speeches. At the end he said, very soon Pesach is coming. Dayenu. And he was meant to be giving like the keynote address, and he just sat down and was done with it. And so you got here again in Chazal, there is nothing better than silence. And that's not only strategically true if you're speaking to a room full of people and it's late at night and people are tired. It's seen as more than anything wise you can say, silence will be wiser. And we often have this, we feel like, you know, if you're in an awkward conversation, like I need to fill the air with something. And then we say something, oop, I shouldn't have said that, or I said that wrong. Better to be quiet and just absorb what you're hearing than to say the wrong thing. Now that can be paralyzing, so I'm never going to say anything in my life. So there's obviously got to be a balance, but sometimes silence is golden. As they say, Kiyata Rav Dimi Amar, when Rav Dimi came, he said, Amri B'mar Rava, what do they say in the West, meaning in Israel? Mila Basela, if a word is worth a dollar, mushtuka bitrin, silence is worth two. So again, this notion that silence is golden, that don't feel like I need to fill the air with noise. Sometimes it's better to be quiet than to say the wrong thing. I should note, sometimes it's better to say the right thing than to be quiet, but the risk of saying the wrong thing seems to be quite high. Full stop. So that was addressing the first point in the Mishnah, of the first Mishnah of the second Perek, that the Megillah needs to be set in order. Order, chronology is important. It tells a story and it instills a human reaction that just downloading information would not. My computer doesn't care what order it downloads information. You know what? I have no idea, actually. I don't know how to code. I assume maybe computers do need things to be downloaded in a certain order, but it's not going to have an emotional reaction. It's just because it needs to code in a certain way. The way human beings code is we have emotive reactions to information, and if it's not done right, it can play with us, and to some degree, maybe that's why we end with this silence. The risk of evoking or provoking the wrong reaction is so easy with speech. We can say, you know, slightly wrong tone, slightly wrong order, slightly wrong emphasis. It is perilous to engage in speech. And that's why order is so key and so important at this outset. Kral Pelo Yatsa. This is the third of the widest lines in the gray. We said, if you read the Megillah Baal Peh, you don't fulfill the obligation. Meaning, if you've just lain the Megillah so many times, you can just recite it on your own by heart, you have not fulfilled your obligation. Which is strange, right? You're thinking, what is the point of the Megillah? To tell the story. How many of us can see the person lain in the Megillah, that the Megillah is there? We're looking at what's in our hand, or we're sitting down there up high. They get it all right. I've heard the Megillah. Why does it matter that it's from a cloth? Or from a text at all. But we're told if it's not from a text, you don't fulfill your nalan. How do I know? Amar Rav Rava says, Ad Schira Schira, we have this Zereshava. The word Schira appears in two different contexts, once in the Megillah and once elsewhere. Ktiv Hachava Yamim Elin Itzkarim. At the end of the Megillah, it says these days will be remembered. Ktiv Hatam, and there concerning the annihilation of Amalek, it says, Ktav Zot Zikaron Basefer. It should be written as a memory. Basefer. So now we know you need to have a text for Purim, because you need to have a text for Zechirat HaMalek, which tells you, again, it sounds like that this is a firm obligation that to do the mitzvah of Zechirat HaMalek, you need to have a sefer in front of you. Malahan basefer, become basefer. Mamaida Zechira Kriya. How do I know that there with Amalek, it says Zikaron basefer? How else might you remember something in a book other than reading it out loud? Reading it to yourself, right? Meaning, so now I know that I need to have a text, but who says I got to read it out loud? So this is now a second question. So far we said, how do I know if you read it out loud, you need a text? We said, well, it says Zechira, so you need a text. And we said, okay, now you said you need a text. How do I know to read it out loud? Where does that come from? Dilma Iyun Ba'alma, maybe just look at it with your eyes. Don't think that. Zachor, it says Zachor, Yachol Belev, and you might think, oh, I can remember it in my heart. Kashu Omer Lo Tishkach, but it also says Lo Tishkach. What does Lo Tishkach mean? Hoshichat Lev Alma. That means within you have to remember it. So I'll look at the page and I'll remember it. Hamani Makayim Zachor, why does it say Zachor? But pay, you have to say it out loud. So there's now a balance. I need a text and it needs to be verbal. Which is interesting. I don't know if that means, you know, when you're telling a story, but sometimes you think, I don't know how many of you engage in speech giving often. Sometimes people say, you know, you should have a script to read from. Some people say, well, that's a bit stultifying. You want to be able to do it without notes. What's more engaging? What's more compelling? But if we've just said that speech is perilous, it may make sense that you want a script. The chance that you make an error, or intellectually, and I know when I'm speaking and I don't have it written up in front of me, the level of stress that I have that I'm going to forget something or say the wrong thing or miss something is heightened. And at the back of your head, the whole time you're thinking, am I remembering what I'm meant to be saying while I'm saying? If I've written down that this is a crutch that relieves me of that stress, I can just focus on what I'm saying, although it does make it less natural. Do we open doors in this age of security when people knock? All right. Yeah, so, there are also lots of doors upstairs. But then they could go to the upstairs door, right?
Yeah, is there anybody upstairs?
But, I mean, would you naturally come down the stairs?
Yeah, there's a peephole.
Yeah. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's smart.
There's a guy with a jacket, if that makes you feel better or worse.
Very puffy?
Less puffy.
Something in his hand?
We are waiting for you.
Can we open the door?
Oh, right, that's true.
Of course.
Oh, hi, Stu, come on in. Hi, Stu, come on in. No, no problem. I'm going to wrap up before 9:30, don't worry. So we've established now that you need a text and it needs to be verbal in order to balance this perilous speech being concrete. Karatagam Layasa, we said if you read it in translation, you haven't fulfilled your Hechidami. What does that mean in translation? Meaning if I've got a Hebrew script in front of me and I translate it for the audience, is that what we mean you can't read it in translation? Because I've got the text, I've got the script, and I'm saying it out loud, but I'm just translating in my head. What would you say that is, by the way? If I'm saying it out loud in English and I've got the Hebrew script, am I reading the script? No, so that's the same as Baal Peh. That's what it's going to say. Do we make for a vikari le targum hainu Baal Peh? That's the same as reading in Baal Peh. So that can't be what it means. Lo tzricha. No, it's talking about the tivitav vikari le targum. It's talking about you've got an English text. I've got the text. I've got the script. I'm reading from the script. My words are concrete. But you don't fulfill your obligation if it's in translation. So there's something important about the story being in the original language as well.
We have seven tzrichos.
Go on. Meaning Man, Miriam, Matan Torah.
Right. Do they all require?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this does come up in a number of the commentaries in the poskim. Whenever we say Yizchir Yitzir Mitzrayim, for example, does it have to be read in a script and read out loud? There's a debate about that. Depends, again, whether these are minhagim, rabbinic obligations, biblical obligations, if the word Zecher appears somewhere.
I mean, Shabbos also.
Yeah.
you know, Kiddush is
Zachar Yom HaShavuot
HaKadosh. Kiddush, the part that is, fulfills the mitzvah of Zachor.
Yeah, it's but Kiddush, so can you say it out loud, or do you need to have a text? Right, there are questions about this. I don't have them all.
And clearly the Zachor here of Amalek is connected to the Megillah.
Correct. There is a...
Textually.
Correct.
But there are others.
Correct. We'll explore that at a future date. So, Aval Karunatam Bala Az Yatsa. So, having just said, you read it in translation, you don't fulfill your obligation, the Mishnah went on to say, if you read it in a foreign language, you do fulfill your obligation. You just told me I can't read it in translation. Now you're telling me I can read it in translation. What is going on? Rav Shmuel and Tavai, Rav Shmuel both say, Balaz Yevani. Oh, when you can fulfill the obligation, it's in Greek. And this is, you know, a strange moment, but it would be in the contemporary sense, you know, majority of Jews in the world speak one of two languages. Speak Hebrew or English. And if I were to ask you, you know, what language is the greatest literature in the West written in? Probably people say English. You've got Shakespeare, you've got Milton, you've got Chaucer. I mean, this is when people talk about studying literature, you know, sometimes people throw in Cervantes or Dante, and then usually translate it into English. English is seen as a very aesthetically pleasant language that is melded from lots of different sources, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the ancient world, Greek was seen as, I don't know, semi-divine is a word, but the closest you can get outside the realm of Lashon HaKodesh to a language that is fitting, and this is where it appears, where Shimon Gamliel already say this, the Torah is fitting only to be written in Hebrew, and Yevanit in Greek. It's seen it. So while there is this Hellenistic looming cloud that threatens to swallow up Jewish culture, it's at the same time that the rabbis recognize that the Greek language has aesthetic qualities to it. So it seems this is one ramification of that, where Rav and Shmuel say, you can fulfill the Megillah if you read it in Greek. No other language, but in Greek. Yes.
Okay.
Greek is also, like, there's a question about studying Chochmat Yevanit, the wisdom of Greeks, and that's seen as, you know, highly problematic for many. So there's a debate, again, about this tension about whether the language is elevated, but the culture is not. And sometimes Aramaic features the beginning of Brachot. It talks about you can say prayer in Aramaic because the angels don't understand it, and that's a way to get directly to God. So that's, in some ways, Aramaic is seen as a vulgar language. Meaning not vulgar as in rude, but as in common. And Greek is seen as kind of an elite language. It does appear.
You might have thought that you would connect it to Persian, specifically.
The Megillah?
Yeah. That's the...
Yeah, so it's not seen as an elite language, which is, yeah, it is interesting. Although we do adopt a number of Persianized words in our literature, for example, the... maybe the names Esther and Mordechai, although that is not acknowledged by Chazal as being the connection, but the days of the month are Babylonian and Persian. Ilema. Let us see. Dichtiv Ashurukala Yvanit. They said you can read it in Greek, but if it's written in Hebrew and they're reading it in Greek, Hainu Alpeh, that's the same as out loud. So you're telling me Rav and Shmuel. And this is, again, something unintuitive. Rav and Shmuel seem to be saying, if I have a Megillah written in Greek and then read word for word from the text, I fulfill my obligation. Full stop. Yeah, that is what they seem to be saying at this stage, that if you've got a Greek Megillah and you read it in Greek, you fulfill your obligation. Again, not related to Persia, just this is an elite language, seems to be. Now we've got a parenthetical remark for three lines because we just had Rabbi Lazar answer that. Rabbi Lazar is now going to make a remark, which we kind of throw in as something else he said. We don't have time to excavate why this might be related here, but we'll kind of move past it after three lines. How do I know that God called Yaakov El? Says Rabbi Lazar. Shneemar, it says, V'yikrelo El Elohei Yisrael. This is after Yaakov builds the Mizbeach. It says, and he called Lo means either him or it, and we tend to read it, he called it, meaning the Mizbeach, El, Elohe Yisrael, God, the God of Israel, if you think that Yaakov is calling Mizbech El, v'ikralo Yaakov, I should have said, and Yaakov called it. There's too many non-names here for it to be Yaakov doing it. Ela v'ikralo Yaakov El, it is saying that Yaakov was called El. V'ikralo, he called him El. Mikaru El, and who called him El? Elohe Yisrael, the God of Israel. So God calls Yaakov El, like a powerful being, based on that verse, full stop, that was a small diversion. Meitfei, we have a brayta. And this is going to give us pause to what we've just said. According to Rav and Shmuel, you can read a Greek Megillah in Greek, fulfill your obligation. We're going to push back. Cry gifrit, ifrit, ilmit, midit, yvanit, lo yatsa. There is a brayta. If you read it in any of those languages, ifrit, they're not being Hebrew, but some other Canaanite dialect. Any of those languages, you don't fulfill your obligation. Hello, Damya and Elalahat. No, hold on. We need to contextualize that brighter because it does sound like that's devastating to Rav and Shmuel, says you can read it in Greek. This is what it means. Gifrit le giftim, ivrit le ivrit, ilmim le ilmim, yivanit le yivanim yatsa. If you read it to a group who will understand it, you fulfill your obligation. Meaning if I get up with a Greek Megillah and I read the Greek to an audience who doesn't speak Greek, you have not fulfilled your obligation. So this is a way where Greek and Hebrew do diverge. They seem to be on par. You can read Greek Megillah in Greek, but if nobody understands it, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Why then does Rav and Shmuel establish it as only talking about Yevanit? You should say with any language, as we've just said in the previous brighter, if you read it in gifted to the gifted, you fulfill your obligation. So why do they say only Greek? It sounds like any language you can fulfill if you do it to a group who understands it. Elamah needing a brighter. They follow a brayta, and when Rav and Shmuel say it, they say it in generic terms as follows. This is how we're going to solve the various paradoxes. Rav and Shmuel take the following view: la'az yevani l'chol kasher, that Greek is distinct in that it is kosher for everybody, meaning even if you don't understand it. It is true. So it's now back on par with Hebrew. You can read a Greek Megillah in Greek to a whole audience who doesn't know what you're saying, and they fulfill their obligation. Vaktani Yevanim le Yevanim in Lekolei Amalo. But hold on, the brayta we just read said Ilmin le Ivrit and Yevanit Yevanit. So it sounds like only if it's to people who understand Greek, not to anybody else. Inu da amagru shumin galo. They don't follow that brayta. They follow Shimon Gamliel, who takes the following view. Did not Shimon Gamliel omer afsvarim lo hitu shikru le Yevanit. The Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Sfarim, meaning Sifrei Torah, can be written in Hebrew or in Greek. Now, again, why is Greek? We said it's an elite language. It's also assumed that translation from Hebrew to Greek, there is no loss of semantic meaning. That's the assumption, that it holds all the meaning, so nothing's lost in translation, which is why Greek is uniquely fitting. And they say, that's why if I say it to a whole audience who doesn't understand it, I fulfill my obligation. Which would beg the question, what's the point of telling the story if no one understands what you're saying? Any guess?
In Hebrew also.
Right. So in Hebrew, let's say nobody understands what you're saying. What's the point of doing it? How do you fulfill your obligation? What are you trying to do in telling this story in totality if nobody knows what you're saying?
There's a story.
I could do it in French. There's a story. But we say it doesn't work in French if no one understands it. In Hebrew, if no one understands it, it's fine. What are you accomplishing?
Maybe somebody will try to learn Hebrew, become more proficient. And,
yeah. Right, meaning you're keeping the story alive. It's true nobody understands it, but you're keeping it alive. Someday someone will be able to plug into it. But if you, so let's say I did it in French, I'm not keeping the story alive because there's a loss in translation. There's a shift. And if someone then learns French and then understands it, it's like, oh, now I've got access. No, you think you have, but you don't understand it. But if it's in Greek or Hebrew, it seems, you are maintaining the story so that someday someone can re-access without loss the story that's being told, which tells you that partially what we're doing when we're praying and when we're laning, it is not just we need to understand what's happening in this moment, but we are perpetuating a national service for our next generation and beyond that. We are keeping these texts and these stories alive. You might think it's a waste of time. I'm sitting here. I don't know what they're laning. I don't know what they're saying. What's the point? But actually what we're doing collectively is perpetuating our legacy. And you may think it's a waste of time, but we're making sure that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-grandnephews and nieces are going to have this text uninterrupted from thousands of years, and we are doing an educational service. You know, many of our ancestors would have said, you know what, I'm never going to live in a nice house, but I'm working hard, I'm doing 14 jobs so that someday you can have what I never had. And that's what we're doing educationally. I don't speak good Hebrew, I don't understand grammar, but I'm sitting here, and I'm going to sit for 45 minutes through laning, bored out my brains, because I'm doing a service for the next generation, so that when they get the education that I don't have, I've done my service in handing it on. So actually, it's not a passive, I'm bored out my brains listening to this laning every week. I am carrying forward actively Jewish legacy. And it seems to be that from Shimon Gamliel, Greek does that service too. Yeah.
I just want to say that there's a difference between Zecher and Sipur. Zecher and Sipur. Sipur, you need to actually understand and explain, and it should be in a language and a conversation, like the Seder.
Right. So meaning Sibbutz Mitzrayim, the mitzvah to do Sibbutz Mitzrayim on Seder night is different to Zechiyat Mitzrayim when you say Kriyat Shema every night. I don't have to understand necessarily everything I'm saying in Shema, but if I don't understand what I'm saying at the Seder, I haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of Sipur.
Sipur seems to be more ritualistic, whereas the Sipur seems to be more content.
Yeah, meaning memory, perpetuating memory is not self-focused. It's not, I am remembering something, but I am the bearer of a memory. I am keeping it alive. And you could think of it as like an heirloom. You know, I've got a box. I'm not using it. I may not even know what's in it. I just know that I've been given this treasure by my ancestors that I need to pass it on. And I'm going to hand it on to you. And that's what memory is. It is handing something on the mind I may not have full access to. But if there's, you know, if there's a code on the outside, I preserved it. So someday, if somebody figures it out, they'll have access to something I don't. But that doesn't mean I'm useless. If I dumped it or let go of it or I forgot the language or the code, I've failed. So it does. It empowers, Zechira empowers the common people to be proactive bearers of memory, even if they're not engaging with it in a personal sense. Absolutely. Okay. Middle of that line, first of all, the Rishimim Gamliel Omer in the pink. The lame Halacha Rishimim Gamliel. So why do they, Rav and Shmuel, say, oh, you should read it in Greek? Just say Halacha Rishimim Gamliel. And we'd understand, as a consequence of that, that they think Greek is equivalent to Hebrew, and you can read the Megillah in Greek. Because if they said Halacha Rishimim Gamliel, and that's all, Hava Mina, you might think Hanamil Rishad Sfarim. They agree with him in terms of Tanakh generally, of a Megillah, but with Megillah, they wouldn't. Echtiv Ba'kich Davam, because it says in the Megillah, it should be in their writing. So you might think it has to be in Hebrew, Kamash Malan. No. So Shmuel, so full stop, Rav and Shmuel think if you have a Greek Megillah and you read it in Greek, even if nobody understands what you're doing, you've fulfilled your obligation, which is not practiced very often. And we said, oh, and if you read it to a group of people who speak French, but you read it in Hebrew from a Hebrew Megillah, you fulfilled your obligation. And this is when the Gemara is now going to raise the question that has been percolating with us for the last few lines. But they don't know what you're saying. And this, I have to say, is something that strikes me often. You know, last Motzei Shabbos, we had the Megillah, we're sitting there, we're reading, and there was this instinct. And when I grew up, there were rabbis who did this. They would, in between each of the prakim, provide a small summary of what just happened in the chapter and what's about to happen in the chapter, which is almost like a public confession. None of us actually know what's happening, apart from occasionally we boo because we hear a word. But on the whole, I need to tell you what's happening, and then we'll read. And in some ways, that disempowers the text, because we recognize that we need to get through the Hebrew, and then we'll announce what was happening. And this is the rabbi saying, what is the point of this? If you're reading to a group who doesn't speak Hebrew, and you're doing in Hebrew or Greek for Reuven Shmuel, they don't understand. Midi lahava anashim v'amei ha'aretz. And this is when the Gemara says, you know, it's not ideal, but this happens all the time, says Gemara, with those who are not literate. And at the time, that involved women and common laborers. They didn't have time to go to education. They were either dealing with home affairs or dealing with work in the fields. They don't have time to sit and study and how to read. So, of course, there are people who don't understand. Markiv la Ravina. Ravina, the man of the common people, comes in and says, hold on a minute, you elitists, saying that it's just women and Amoratsim who don't understand things. Anan atua achtar panim b'nei ramachim miyadina. Do we understand everything in the Megillah? There is a phrase in the Megillah that none of us know what it means. And anyone know what achtar nim b'nei ramachim means? I mean, at that point, we'd all get out the art scroll, we'd get out the Sansino, we'd say, well, I'll see how they translate it, but on its own, these are not natural terms. And there are suggestions that, and if you look in the translation, suddenly we think, oh wow, it's talking about flying camels, or like, it's like, oh, this is an unusual term that we don't really understand. Ela mitzvahs kriya o prasume nisa, and this is how the Gemara settles on what the point of reading the Megillah is. In the context where there are words that none of us understand, the point is to read and to publicize the miracle. You don't have to understand every word. You don't have to know every phrase. You just have to understand this is a story about redemption, and we're reading it together, and we're publicizing the miracle. So too, when you're reading to a group of people who don't understand, and it's in Hebrew, what are you accomplishing? You're spreading the miracle, and you're reading. And we've said that there is what we might call, I guess, a vertical surface, that this is talking about the future and the past. We're passing something, I don't know if vertical is the right word, or I'd say chronological maybe, that you are handing on. And that's our service. We're keeping this story alive. And the suggestion maybe is also there's a horizontal service. What are we doing when we're all together? We're all participating. We're building solidarity. We're building a group. This is Rabbi Berman spoke about this at Sudash Hashid a little bit yesterday, that we are becoming part of something larger than ourselves. I don't understand it, but I'm listening. We're all saying the Amidah at the same time. I don't understand every bracha, but what I do understand is these words have been said for hundreds of years by my ancestors, and it will be said, please God, for many more generations. And it's being said by a room of people right now. And maybe none of us know what it is, but we're all doing it together, and that brings us together. This is a mitzvah of kriyah and prasuminissa. We are engaging in an act larger than just the meaning of the words that we're reciting as a public demonstration, he says, and that's why you can read in Hebrew or Rishmol in Greek. For a group of people who don't understand it. Full stop. Kriya Sirugin Yatsa. We said if you read it in installments, you fulfill the obligation. Meaning I've read chapter 1, I take a break for a little bit, I read chapter 2, I take a break, I read chapter 3, take a little break for a little bit. It's fine. And now the Gemara is going to go on a little side note. We may have to finish before we get to end. The Dav Lava Yada Rabbana Mai Sirugin. The rabbis didn't know what the word Sirugin meant. And now we're going to suggest a whole series of words. The rabbis didn't know their meaning until they overheard a maidservant say something using the word and say, oh, that's what it means. So they didn't know what Sirugin meant. Shmaila Amta Debre Rebbe. They heard the maidservant of the house of Rebbe, Tekamra La Rabbana, and that she was speaking to a group of rabbis. Avro Aile Piske Piske Lebe Rebbe. They were coming in for the Shia. And they were coming in, in spurts. So, two rabbis came in, another two came in. And she said to them, Alma Tatem, Nichnasim Sirugin Sirugin, why are you coming in these like little spurts? And we said, oh, that's what Sirugin means. It means to read the Megillah in spurts, meaning in little bits. Lavidan Rabbani, my Chalug Lugos. The rabbis didn't know what the Chalug Lugos means. Shama La'amtad Bei Rebbe. They heard the maidservant of Rebbe's house. Damri Leila who gavra to come abu parim nachli. She saw this guy who was kind of perfuming and spreading, spritzing, I don't know the word, spritzing perfume around. Ad my time, mafazeh chalug latecha. How long are you going to start spritzing your perfumer? And said, oh, that's what chalug latecha means, perfume. Lava yada rabbana my salsalat ramecha. They didn't know the word from Tanakh saying that your salsala and you will be raised. Shemola amta de bei Rebbe. They heard the maidservant of Rebbe, Dava Amrila hu gafra. She saw a person, Dava mafech b'maziah, who was playing with his hair. Amrele, she said, how long are you going to be twirling your hair for? And they said, oh, masalsa means to twirl or to fiddle with. Lava yada rabbanan mai hashlach al Hashem yahavech. They said, they didn't know what it meant, that cast upon God, yahavech, what does yahavech mean? They didn't know. Amrele, zimnachada, Ramachan said, once upon a time, havazina bahade havetaya, I was wandering with a certain Arab, v'kadarina tuna, and I had a lot of burden I was carrying on my back. Ramalin shekuli avich v'shadei gamla, he said, take your burden and put it on my camel. So we know Yahaveh, or Yahev, means burden. So it says, cast your burden upon God. That's what that verse means. So who's telling us what words mean so far? Yeah, maidservants and Arab merchants. Those seem to be articulate ways of establishing a Hebrew meaning. Lava yada rabbanan mai v'tai v'tai mi'hashmed. And the rabbis didn't know what v'tei ta'er b'tamatei, you shall destroy. They didn't know what those two words meant. Shama'u la'amta debei Rebbe. They heard again the maidservant of Rebbe, Dahava amilachareta, that she said to her peer, or to her fellow maidservant, shakule ta'atei, take the broom v'tai tebeta and sweep the house. Said, oh, ta'atei means broom. Now, in theory, how might the maidservant of Rebbe's house be a good source for the meaning of words? What might you say? Oh, the reason we can trust her is because, yeah, maybe she heard it from Rebbe. Why does that not fully work? Okay, well, that's one option, but also the Arab presumably didn't hear it from Rebbe. So that kind of seems to disprove this idea that's the source. It seems to be that what sometimes common people preserve this, and maybe this is buttressing the argument, that if you just hold on to language, somebody will become expert, and somebody who uses it with confidence will tell you what it means, it seems to be. Full stop. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbi said, Karen Serugin Yatsa, if you read it in spurts, you fulfill Serusin. If you read it with larger gaps or cut off, Lo Yatsa, you don't fulfill the obligation. We can go just for a few more minutes. Rabbanan Amrushav Rabbi Yehuda, the next 10 lines are just going to be, who do we follow in practice? So Rabbanan said in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, Abba Serugin, even if you read it in spurts, Im Shahakadeh Ligmart Kula Chogel Arosh, you can't stop for like half an hour. If you stop, and you stop more than the time it would take Ligmorit Kula to finish it all, you have to go back to the beginning. So hold on a minute. If you pause longer than it would take to finish it all, how long is that, roughly, would you say?
No.
That's how long it takes to read the Megillah?
Depends when you pause.
Depends when you pause. Well, that's going to be the question. What if I pause at the beginning of chapter 10? How long is it going to be till I would finish?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. So the Gemara is now going to say, we follow that view that if you pause too long, you have to go back to the beginning. Rav Yosef says, Rav Yosef, hold on a minute. You're talking about the amount of time it would take to finish from where you pause until the end. Are you talking about how long it would take to read from beginning to end? It says, that would mean from beginning to end. And otherwise, the whole thing becomes like a guesstimate. How long would it take to finish? So you just follow Debbie. How long does it take to read the Megillah? Half an hour. If you pause for half an hour, you have to start again. But if you pause for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, that's okay. Rav, in the name of Rav, they said, we follow Rav Muna, which means if you pause for too long, you have to start again. Shmuel says, no. In Pomedita, they taught it differently, only that it was Rav Kahana who said this in the name of Rav, but the same thing. Rav said, Alacha Rav Muna, Shmuel Amar Ein Alacha Rav Muna. There's a debate between Shmuel and Rav. One says we follow Rav Muna, one says we don't. Rav Bibi Mane Ibcha, and just for the record, Rav Bibi reads it the other direction, but BB is not too popular at the moment. But he says, we read it in the other direction, that Rav Amai Ein Halacha Rav Muna, Shmuel Amar Halacha Rav Muna. So what does Rav say? Do we follow Rav Muna or we don't? That's the question. There seems to be two different readings of this order. Am Rav Yosef Nakit de Rav Bibi Biyadecha. You should hold what Rav Bibi says in your hand, meaning you should follow the view that Shmuel says you follow Rav Muna, that if you pause for too long, you have to go back to the beginning. Even though it's more machmir. The other view is, as long as you say it all, you can pause. And according to Rav Muna, if you pause for too long, you have to go back to the beginning. Shmuel says that according to Rav Bibi, and Rav Bibi says it makes sense. Abai says it makes sense. Sorry, Rav Yosef says it makes sense to follow Rav Bibi's view of Shmuel, that he is the more machmir one. Why? Because Shmuel is worried about a single view, and we're going to prove that did none as it was taught. 2 seconds of background to the question of Yibam. The case of Yibam is, you've got a married couple, the husband has a brother. Unfortunately, this couple who are trying to have children are not blessed with children, so the husband then passes away. So you've now got a brother and the surviving widow. They have an obligation to perform one of two things, Yibam or Chalitza. And in the meantime, according to all views, if you've studied Yavamos, there's what's called a Zika, a kind of connection or a bond between these two, even before Yibam is conducted, to the extent that it's almost like they're semi-married. They have to do Chalitza or Yibam. Yibam would almost complete the Zika, the bond, and Chalitza is kind of a divorce. But at this point, they are in a relationship, which means that the brother of the man who passed away, if he has a relationship with the sister of this widow, that's Arayos. Meaning he can marry whoever he wants. He's single, the sister's single. If they now have a relationship and he's got a zika, a bond with this woman he needs to do yibam with, he's going to be put to death for doing arayos because there's established bond. Now, that's only true for the majority of you if there's only one surviving brother. Because once a husband passes away, you've got this widow and one brother. We all know who's going to have to do yibam or chalitza, so there's a zika established. And the overwhelming view is if there are three brothers, there's no zika and they can all, you know, do whatever relationships they need, but if there's one left, he's the one who's got to do it. So it may be that there's a sudden rush. If everybody doesn't like this widow, everyone's tried to get married straight away, so they don't have to be the one who has to perform chalitza or yibam. But there is a view, a minority view, Reuben Batera, that even if there are multiple brothers, they all have a kind of zika. And they all have an obligation that's diffuse, and none of them can do any of the forbidden relationships as if they were married to her. But that's a minority view. And we're now going to say, and Shmuel is worried for that minority view, so it makes sense to say Shmuel is the one who follows Rabbi Amnon, that if you pause for too long, you go to the beginning. How do I know Shmuel worries for the minority view? Did none, as it says, for as long as my Shomer. Shomer at Yavam, Shekidesh Achivet Achata, in a case where there is someone who is waiting to do Yibam, and the brother marries the widow's sister, in a case when there were many, many brothers, we say to him, we say, don't act on this relationship. You've just in Kedushin with someone who's an Erva. You cannot complete that marriage until your brother has married and done Yibam or done Chalitza, because there is a Zika. And Shmuel says, we follow that view, because we are worried about minority view. Let's just do the yellow. Tanu Rabbanu, the rabbis taught, Shmuel bar Sefti Oda Pesukim V'Kana Karim Togim Minayatse. He says, if you are reading from a book that doesn't have letters in it and is missing Pesukim, you fulfill your obligation. You're reading from the Megillah and there's a Pasuk missing and you just said it out loud because you remember it. Fulfill the obligation. Make for holding a minute. There is a writer that says, Hayu bar Otiyot Mitushtachot O Makuraot, said, if you're reading a text that has got kind of messed up or ripped out letters, imushumam nikakshe, right? If you can figure out the meaning, it's kosher, imlab psula. If not, it's possible. So hold on, you told me if it's missing letters, it's okay. Now I'm saying if it's kind of messy, but you can make it out, it's kosher. It sounds like it's missing letters, you can't make it out. That doesn't work. Lo kasha, habakula habamiksata. It says, if it's fully there and hard to read, you have to be able to recognize it. But if a little bit is completely missing, you fulfill your obligation. Tan Rabban, the rabbi say, Hishmet Bakara Pasuk Echad, if the person reading misses a verse, Lo Yomai Krat Kol Avachakarak Pasuk, you shouldn't say, so you're in the middle of Shul, you're doing Megillah, and then you missed a Pasuk. You spaced out, or there was a noise and you missed a Pasuk. Don't say, I'm going to listen to this in the Megillah, and then I'll come back and read that Pasuk. Ela Korama Oto Pasuk Velech, you should read that Pasuk, start reading to catch up, and then catch up. Everything has to be in order. Nichlas Veza Knesset, Matzah Sibish Korah Chetzia. If you walk into Shul and the Sibir's already read half the Megillah, Lo Yoma Krechetzia Matzibir Rachachir Chetzia. Don't say, oh, I'll read half, this second half now, and then I'll read my first half. Later, Ela Korah Oto Mitzchilav Atzelf, you have to read from beginning to end and catch up. We'll start with sleeping, mit nanem yat, so that if you are slumbering during the Megillah, you fulfill your obligation. When you say, let's define this a little bit. What is slumbering involved? I've seen various stages of sleep unfolding in Shul. Let's draw a line at what you still fulfill the obligation to do Megillah or not. So that's where we'll start next time. But in the meantime, I wish you all the week. In about 10 minutes, we'll have The Promise of Liberty from Dr. Stuart Halpern, Rabbi Dr. Stuart Halpern. Everyone is invited, encouraged to stay.